Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Renterham, our editorial director, and our digital editor, Tiffany's on vacation, but she'll be back with us next time. So once again, we're missing on our Tiffany. Our schedules have been a little crazy lately, between trade shows and holidays, so we decided that for this episode, we're going to do things a little different. We're going to have two interviews. At the top of the episode, we'll feature Barbara's discussion with Don Schaffner from Rutgers University about the recent hand-washing study that we covered. And this will be replacing our regular news and trends segment. So if you're still feeling like you need a dose of news and trends, you can visit foodsafetymagazine.com, where you can see all of our recent posts, or check us out on Twitter, at Food Safety Mag. After that, we'll hear Barbara's interview with John Spink, the director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University and a contributor to Food Safety Magazine. John is a leading expert on the topic of food fraud and economically motivated adulteration. And as always, we're very pleased to have such great guests join us on the podcast. Okay, let's dive in. To give everyone some background, Dr. Don Schaffner is Distinguished Professor and Extension Specialist in Food Science at Rutgers University. He's published over 150 peer-reviewed papers on a variety of topics, including hand-washing, cross-contamination, quantitative microbial risk assessment, and predictive food microbiology. Dr. Schaffner has educated thousands of food industry professionals through short courses and workshops in dozens of countries around the world. He has served on a variety of national and international expert committees, including service to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the World Health Organization and Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. He holds a B.S. in food science from Cornell University and an M.S. and Ph.D. in food science and technology from the University of Georgia. And Don co-hosts a podcast on microbial food safety called Food Safety Talk, which you can find on iTunes. It's really great to have a fellow podcaster join us.
Well, just to refresh a little bit about this study that I talked to Don about, they had some major findings. The first was that cool water is just as effective as hot water in reducing bacterial numbers when hand washing. The amount of soap that they looked at for the washing did not seem to matter, but you needed to wash your hands at least 10 seconds to significantly remove bacteria. So if these results really stand up, they could be a game changer with regard to hand washing and water temperature guidelines for the food service industry, should FDA choose to revisit and update these guidelines.
Okay, here's the interview.
Well, hi, Don. It's great to have you on our podcast today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, we want to thank you for reaching out to us when we covered the Rutgers hand washing study in one of our news and trends segments. And as you noticed, I had a couple questions about the study. But what I also did was I looked through all the press releases about this particular study and listened to your podcast with Ben Chapman, Food Safety Talk, where you discussed the results of this study. And actually, now that I've listened to the two of you speak, I have a few more questions.
I hope none of them are too embarrassing about our taste in music or popular culture.
Actually, I was intrigued by, you know, obviously part of the impetus for doing the study was to subtly influence FDA when they update their guidelines for hand washing and water temperature. And there was a lot of discussion that you and Ben had about some subjective language about being comfortable when you wash your hands and that the temperature should be comfortable. So I guess I wanted to hear from you. How do you think FDA will be able to update their guidelines that in support of the science that you have found in a way that, you know, FDA says they don't want to be prescriptive about guidelines, but I'm not sure saying, you know, comfortable water temperature is something that I foresee FDA adding language too.
Well, right. And so first, let's take a step back and say that we're really, what we're talking about here is the FDA Model Food Code, which is the document that is not a regulatory document. It's a model document that gets adopted by the states in writing their food codes, which regulates restaurants and food service operations, retail operations within their states. So I certainly hope that we've done some science that can help inform good policy decisions. And as you no doubt heard us talk about, there's two provisions in the code where we think that this research might have some impact. First of all, the code explicitly states that hands must be washed in warm water. And I think that our research shows that, in fact, warm water is not required because we showed that 60 degrees Fahrenheit water was no different than 80 or 100. And 100, I would say, probably feels like hot water to people. 80 probably feels like warm water. But we didn't show any difference. But the other provision of the code is that hand washing sinks must be capable of dispensing water at 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And again, there may be some practical reasons why you want sinks to dispense that, but at least the science in our article doesn't support that in any way. There's no reason why a hand wash sink has to dispense water at 100 degrees if 60 degrees will have the same efficacy in removing bacteria from the hands. So, but again, what we talked about on the podcast and what we can talk about here, which is where I sort of net out using this language of comfortable, what we want people to be able to do is quickly and easily and effectively wash their hands. And if the water is too hot or the water is too cold, neither of those things are comfortable. And so what you want to do is you Barbara, you want to wash your hands in water that's comfortable for you, and I want to be able to wash my hands in water that's comfortable for me. And as long as we can both achieve that, what is that subjective comfort level, then we're going to do the best job we can at washing our hands because we're not being distracted by water that's too hot or too cold. Now, I realize that putting something like comfortable in the food code is problematic potentially, but that is, as I've searched my soul, my food safety soul, to figure out what should the code say, I keep coming back to that because we want people to be comfortable so they can do a good job.
Do you think that you would have some luck in persuading FDA to make some updates more on length of washing or some, you know, scrubbing action as opposed to focusing on water temperature?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think that the code is already quite prescriptive, and I'm not sure. I mean, certainly, so we studied four different lather times. We studied 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 20, and 40 seconds. And what we saw was no difference in the only difference we saw was between a 5 second lather time and a 20 second lather time. We didn't see statistically significant differences between any of the other lather times. And so where I net out then based on our research is that you need to use a lather time of at least 10 seconds. Now, what the current code says is a lather time of 10 to 15 seconds. So that doesn't really move us too far from what the code says. Now, the other interesting area would be in the use of antibacterial versus plain soaps, which is a very controversial area. Our research in this paper, as well as in other research that we've done, has shown that these antibacterial soaps are indeed more effective. It's a small difference, but it is a statistically significant one, and it may even have, based on our computer simulations, I would say that it does have an effect on public health. Now, to balance that or to frame that, the part of FDA that writes the food code is FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. There's another part of FDA that regulates antibacterial soaps, and that's the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, FDA CDER, as opposed to FDA CIFSAN. And FDA CDER recently, about a year ago, released regulations that basically will effectively ban many of these common antibacterial agents in soaps that are sold over-the-counter to consumers. So if I want an antibacterial hand wash that contains triclosan, for example, I've got, I think, until the end of this month, or maybe it was the end of last month, to be able to buy those on the market. After that, they're going to be gone, and many of the manufacturers have already started phasing them out. Now, fortunately, hand soaps for food service and hand soaps for food processing operations are not regulated in the monograph that FDA CDER uses to regulate these products. And so for right now, for this foreseeable future, these products are available for use in food service, and I would like to see that not go away. Now, whether that needs to be codified in the food code or not, I don't know.
Does your lab, one of the potential future directions of the research that we're talking about today is looking long-term at the use of antibacterial soaps and development of resistance. Is your lab looking at that, or, what is the science behind that?
Well, that's a really good question, and that was one of your questions in the segment that piqued my interest when you were talking about the research before. That is not an area where we do research. What we have focused on is trying to quantify efficacy, to establish whether these products have a benefit, and if so, what is the benefit, and what does that mean in terms of food safety. Our lab is not really equipped to do the kind of research looking at resistance development that you're talking about. I know when FDA CDER made the decision to ban products like triclosan, what they said two things. The first thing they said was these products don't have an impact. And second, they said there may be ecological or other consequences. And I have focused the research that we've done on refuting that first claim. Now, they still, again, and it's a little bit of a different mindset. FDA CDER, these guys regulate pharmaceuticals. And so for them, the standard of proof is the double-blind crossover placebo type experiment. And so the folks in the soap industry talk about doing this like a two-island study. You need to find two islands. You put antibacterial soap on one island. You use plain soap on the other island. And then you look and see what the effect is on diarrheal or foodborne disease. And unfortunately, the margins on soap are much less than the margins on heart medicine or Viagra or what have you, such that the industry is just simply not going to put the money into doing the kind of research that CDER wants. So again, the question about are they effective or not, I think they are based on all the data that I've analyzed, and we've done literature reviews, we've analyzed other people's data, we've done our own studies, and it always shows up that these compounds have a small but significant effect. The effect of ecological consequences or development of resistance, I think, is an interesting area, but it's just not one that we've waded into. It's just not the kind of science that we do.
Sure. Well, we just have come up with a thesis project for somebody else at Rutgers, I guess.
Exactly.
So the other question that I had that we had talked about when we did this news segment was, and you address this with Ben, obviously when you're doing a human study, you can't cover these people with pathogens and look at reduction.
Well, you could, but you would get in a lot of trouble with your biosafety review panel at your university, because either you would submit the protocol and they would reject it, or maybe they would accept it, but it's a lot hard. It was a hard enough bar to be able to get to allow us to put non-pathogenic E. coli or a strain of Enterobacter that's not a human pathogen on people's hands.
Right, and it occurred to me, based on my work, my former life in the lab, that everyone and their mother uses a model system or a surrogate organism. So studies have been done this way for a long time, and yours is no exception. So I thought, water temperature might not have an effect on this non-pathogenic strain, but what about the pathogens? And then I was listening to your podcast and heard about this hand washing machine that your graduate student is working on. And I thought, okay, is human skin so much like pig skin that this is directly yes. applicable? I mean, is this the closest we're going to get to looking at reduction of pathogen load?
Well, here's the thing. If I put a surrogate strain on pig skin, and I put a pathogen strain on pig skin, and I rub the two pieces of pig skin together in our machine, and I get the same reduction, you know, and I apply soap, blah, 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 friction is the same and pressure is the same. Yeah, that's pretty good. The next step that you can do, and we haven't done this, but we talked about this before we went with the pig skin model, you can actually get cadaver skin, right? You can get skin from dead people, and you can do that. And so that is a possibility. Another possibility is you could use real live volunteers and use gloves. But then that raises the same question. Well, what is the nature of attachment to gloves versus the nature of attachment to human skin? So that's a possibility. You could find mutants. And again, our research was done with E. coli, with a laboratory strain of E. coli that's commonly used in these hand washing experiments. You could, I guess, find a pathogenic strain of E. coli and then find a way to take the virulence markers out. You could do the same thing with other pathogenic strains. There are a virulent strains of Salmonella that a number of my colleagues have used and that we've used for other research, and so that's a possibility. But my guess is, from doing a lot of this kind of research and looking at a lot of this kind of data, is that there are small differences between bacteria and viruses. I think that there are very, very small differences or non-existent differences between different species of bacteria. So one of the papers that we published a while back was basically a meta-analysis of the peer-reviewed literature on hand washing. And what we discovered was there was not a difference between gram-positive and gram-negative organisms, right? So we're talking about very large classes of bacteria. We really didn't see a difference between gram-positive and gram-negative. What we did see was a difference between gram-positive and gram-negative organisms where they are added deliberately to the hands versus the natural flora found on hands. But I think that is explained by something that we still don't completely understand, which is an inoculum size effect. And so basically, the more bacteria we put on hands, the number of bacteria that we put on hands seems to affect our ability to measure a log reduction. And so if we use higher levels of bacteria, we can measure a greater log reduction. If we use lower levels of bacteria, we can't measure as great a log reduction, but that may simply be an artifact of the inoculum or of the detection limit of the method. And so there's still a lot more interesting research to be done as we try to tease out this question and really to answer your question, does this work with surrogates really relate to pathogens? But I think a good start would be those pigskin experiments where we study a pathogen and a non-pathogen side by side. And in related news, we just had a paper accepted in Letters in Applied Microbiology, which is our first paper with this pigskin apparatus research. And we were looking at different surfactants and trying to sort of tease out the effects of different components of soap. So we've at least begun to build a track record there. Now I've just got that graduate student, unfortunately, has already graduated. So now I've got to find another graduate student. But we still have the artificial pigskin hand washing machine. And so we've just got to dust that off and find a student who can use it.
I guess my last question, just hearing you talk, reminded me that, you know, science doesn't operate in a vacuum. So when you inoculate a volunteer's hands with this non-pathogenic strain, it's unusual for someone, a food employee working in food service, to only have one strain of bacteria present. So have you looked at mixtures of organisms when you've done these hand washing studies?
We have not, but remember that we don't do anything other than having them do a hand wash before they come in. I think it's in the protocol. There is always on our skin, there is always a natural microflora there. And so when we do these experiments, we are adding on top of that natural microflora. But I suspect, again, my hypothesis, so I'm a modeling and statistics guy. And so my assumption is always that these things are all going to behave the same. And then if we look to see if there are differences. And so my assumption is if I were to take two strains of bacteria and I were to mix them, I don't think they would behave differently than either of the two strains independently. I think a lot of what's going on in hand washing is not really biological so much as it is physiochemical. In other words, it's really about where do the bacteria locate on the hands, and then what's the nature of the soap, and then what kind of soap. I mean, we know, I mean, for example, we know that soap formulation can make a difference. We know that actually the biggest difference is probably person-to-person technique differences. So person A may wash their hands differently than person B. And we do see that when we look at the data. We see a lot of variability from person to person. People just vary widely in the effectiveness of a hand wash on their own hands.
Well, I think that if FDA can look at the science and have some revised guidelines to reduce energy and water usage for restaurants, that would be a game changer, I think.
Yeah, well, and we'll see, right? So the Conference for Food Protection, where the industry and academia and the regulators get together and help FDA write the model food code, that's coming up next spring. And so I look forward to seeing whether there are any issues submitted and what we can do to move the ball forward.
Great. Well, thanks, Don, for talking about your study and being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Barbara, anytime.
Thanks again, Don, for reaching out and for joining us on the podcast. Next up, Barbara interviews Dr. John Spink, who's the director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University. His MSU packaging PhD work was on anti-counterfeit strategy, and his broad research expands from food fraud to product fraud-related business risks, including enterprise risk management, and a range of outreach activities that cover policy and trade issues. While conducting his research and outreach, he has a full teaching load with graduate courses including Packaging for Food Safety, Anti-Counterfeiting and Product Protection, and Quantifying Food Risk. He is widely published in leading academic journals with important works such as Defining the Public Health Threat of Food Fraud. His leadership positions include product fraud-related activities with ISO, GFSI Food Fraud Think Tank, and USP. Global activities include engagements with the European Commission, Interpol, and Operation Opsin, New Zealand MPI, and serves as advisor on food fraud to the Chinese National Center for Food Safety Risk Assessment. Outreach includes MSU's biannual Food Fraud Massive Open Online course that offers free training and certificates online.
Well, John gave a great background of the whole area of food defense, food fraud, and economically motivated adulteration, and how all of these work together. He also noted where the field currently is and how it fits into the greater realm of preventing food risk. It's always a pleasure to talk to John. I always learn a lot listening to him.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then the interview.
So hi, John, and welcome to our podcast, Food Safety Matters.
Hello, and I'm really pleased to be here. Thank you.
You are a leading expert in the world of food fraud, but I thought for our listeners, we'd really try and define the different terms that are involved, particularly with your institution, Michigan State's involvement with Codex recently in trying to define some of the terms involved in food defense, food fraud, food authenticity. And maybe you could just lead us off by, you know, clarifying some of the terms we'll be using today.
Sure. Well, I think to see where I'm coming from and how we look at it, partially you need to know where we sit and our background. So our background is with our team is we're all mid-career professionals that came back to the university, finishing our PhDs mid-career. So we're dealing in the world of resource allocation decision making. You know, we really look at how companies make decisions or how governments do as well. And so we dig back to the foundation, and we've been in a number of situations where there was a really, really important problem and a proposal that we didn't find that it had a real firm foundation. You know, we couldn't understand or it wasn't presented how it connected to everything else and made it really hard for decision making. So what we've done is really, we focus on the foundation. And that usually gets to be, you know, the very basic definitions just to start. One thing, when we look at the definitions, it's important to step back and see what people have done, how they use them, what's the foundation, but most importantly, how it will be used. And one of the first things we did is we tried to, for ourselves, to explain, you know, what's food fraud in relation to all the other food risks, everything that occurs. So originally, of course, you know, food safety and food defense are things people know. Incident, after an incident. It's a food safety incident or it's a food defense incident. Food safety being something that we kind of know. It's traditional. It's a part of the operation. E. coli, a contaminant of some kind, you know, a piece of plastic, something physical, you know, the HACCP process. And food defense are really then intentional acts that fall outside that area. So that's where we saw the two. But when we started to look at food fraud, and specifically shifting from just looking at incidents to looking at prevention, we really needed to look at the topic separately. What we found is food fraud is fundamentally different from food safety, food defense, or food quality if we're talking about prevention. And that's a real key. Prevention is a key word. And that connects into what the FDA is trying to do with FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, is really shift the efforts to prevention. And Ben Franklin said, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And actually, we researched that, and he was talking about fire prevention in Philadelphia, where he was on one of the first fire department boards. And actually, he said, an ounce of prevention is worth 10 pounds of cure. And so he was really emphasizing the prevention piece. And that's where we really focus. So when we're looking at food fraud and food risks, we need to look at all the risks, because a company or a country needs to protect themselves from all food risks, not just one aspect of it, but all. Now, you as an individual might be accountable or responsible for things like physical contaminants in a product, you know, like metal shavings or something, but your company's worried about it all. So we looked at the very top. And with that, we developed the food risk matrix. And so it's food quality, food fraud, food safety, and food defense. And the key is that the topics are separated by the motivation and the action. And so on one side, for food quality and food safety, it's an unintentional act. And for food fraud and food defense, they're intentional. That's usually how it's split within a company for now, but for addressing it, the intentional side is food defense and food fraud. But we really need to split them up based on the motivation, because we're trying to prevent it. We're not trying to catch it. That's a real key. We're not trying to catch food fraud. We're trying to prevent it. So we'll never test our way to safety, like test our way to food safety, and we'll never arrest our way to food protection. So when we look at the motivation for food defense, the bad guys are trying to get caught. You know, they want this incident to be found out. They're trying to harm people. With food fraud, they're trying to avoid it. So to take a short, simple question, make it longer. Really, with food fraud, what we see is that it's deception for economic gain using food, any type of deception and any type of food. Building on that, there's a more detailed definition, such as GFSI. So GFSI has defined in version 7 of their guidance document a longer definition of food fraud. They also define food defense, and specifically that actions with the intent to harm. And then before that, GFSI really relies on their position paper on food fraud. And the position paper on food fraud covers all types of fraud. So it's raw materials all the way through finished goods, packaged goods in the marketplace. So that product that's on the retailer shelf. And it's also all types of fraud, from intentional adulterant substances to smuggling to tampering, misrepresentation of food, labeling claims, and including explicitly they mentioned I'm reading it here, unimproved enhancements, misbranding, counterfeiting, stolen goods, or others. So counterfeiting and stolen goods are explicitly included in that definition. Now, one thing, when we build upon that, another key concept is FSMA. So the Food Safety Modernization Act. What we see as a major aspect of FSMA is the preventive controls rule. And that's, of course, going to be the most important focus, because there's a lot of teeth to that law. And there's a lot of things that probably need to be adjusted. Now, maybe a company's already doing 95% of what they need to do to comply, but they need to record that. And there's confusion inside FSMA, because originally it seemed that that food fraud or economically motivated adulteration was in the intentional adulteration rule, which is the food defense part of FSMA. But early on in the process, right after the draft of the intentional adulteration rule came out, FDA clarified that EMA was going to be addressed in the preventive controls rule, because FDA stated they felt that preventive controls, prevention, food fraud prevention, was a more efficient way to address it. So at this point, FDA hasn't updated the definition or scope of EMA, which is the U.S.-centric term, but they haven't updated it. But one thing they've clarified is that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, it's been in place since 1938. All types of food fraud for all types of products have been illegal since 1938.
Do you think that since you touched a little bit on the intentional adulteration rule, but that most of the prevention will be taken care of in the PC rule, is there redundancy then, or are they going to be, you know, reiterating the preventive controls in the IA rule? How are those going to fit together?
A key is, regarding FSMA, a key that's been emphasized by FDA, you know, including frequently by the Deputy Commissioner for Food, Dr. Steve Ostroff, is that all the rules for FSMA should be looked at as an entire document, like chapters in a book, you know, because the rule is the overall law is FSMA. So even things that are, if there's a mention of something in the foreign supplier verification rule, it might apply back to the PC rule. So it's really, we're really looking at FSMA compliance overall. But if we do look at the specific rules and the rules that have come out, the IA rule is explicitly and only food defense. Intentional acts for harm with a wide scale types of harm. So disgruntled employees, smaller attacks would not be under that. It's more counterterrorism, food terrorism in the IA rule. So the preventive controls rule is where food fraud and EMA is definitely covered.
How much input did your group at Michigan State have in the construction of either the IA rule or the, you know, food fraud components of the PC rule? And is there anything missing when you look at the final drafts?
Through the process of FDA developing laws or the U.S. developing laws, it's really excellent that there is a there's a range of opportunities to engage formally. So they publish the first drafts in the Federal Register. So there's notices of that, and there's, you know, it's public comment periods. There's also open meetings. So we watch and get alerts when those notices come out with our key terms. So what we've done is early on, we respond to the request for comments and have given those public comments, and also attend and present in a public session. With food fraud and EMA, it was interesting because earlier in May 2009, FDA had a public meeting on EMA for all types of fraud across all FDA products, and just basically invited people from industry to engage and present there at CIFSAN headquarters. And so we were fortunate early on. We had been dealing with some of the food protection folks at FDA, and so we got invited to that meeting. So I was the first non-government person to present, and we presented defining food fraud. So it's been really interesting from the very start to stay engaged and provide insight from, you know, what we see happening around the world. And I think we've seen our fingerprints in the laws where some phrases or the way that they address things have got in there. So it's really excellent to see that the research is being used and efficient by the regulators.
That's great that you've had, you know, input from the very beginning. I'm curious, you know, when food defense and food fraud really came into being. I mean, you mentioned that it was, you know, part of the regulations back in 1938, but at least when I entered this industry, it wasn't talked about as much. And maybe 9/11 kind of spurred, you know, the counterterrorism aspect of that. But could you provide a little historical perspective?
Yeah. So one thing that we've studied the process of how new crimes are identified and prioritized. And so we can go back and look at, one of the examples that we found was human smuggling versus human trafficking. So in the past, it was always the same concept, but it's been important, especially in the U.S., to define the two topics for priority setting, because human trafficking is taking people against their will across the borders. That could be for worker slavery, sex trafficking, things like that. And that's different than human smuggling. So human smuggling is helping someone get across the border that wants to get across the border. So it takes this big problem and separates into two areas. And then there's different types of priority setting. There's different resources needed. So what we've seen over time is that there's evidence of food fraud back in actually the Song Dynasty in about it's definitely the BC period, 1000 BC. So they talked about some tea fraud. So it's been going on forever. And so people say, well, if it's been going on and it's been known, why hasn't it been solved? Well, the key is, I think, along the way that we've been all looking at the response, reaction, trying to catch it. And that's really challenging, especially when there's other bigger issues like a war or like famine. And so the food fraud has fallen off the radar over the years. And so it is illegal in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, 1938, and actually earlier in the Pure Food and Drug Act, 1906. One of the key drivers was what they called fraud jokesters. So fraud was even a part of the very first U.S. food laws. But I think what we saw is that there was this response that an agency, government agencies, not just FDA, but others, are really set up for intervention and response, not so much for prevention. You know, police usually run around and arrest bad guys, catch crime, and firemen drive around to put out fires. But over time, there's been more of a criminal focus on prevention. So that's a fire marshal that checks that the sprinkler systems work or building codes. And that's something that's happened as well. So over time, what we saw is that there were a few incidents that really led to the concern. And first was Sudan Red. And so actually, let me step back and talk about the incidents themselves. You know, the first that we really saw was the Sudan Red. So that was a chemical put into things like spices and sauces to make it brighter. So it's something like paprika to make it more red. And that was something that kept popping up. And so that was kind of odd. That was a concern. And that was around 2007 or so, I think. And then around 2000 later was melamine. Sudan Red was around 2002. 2007 was melamine that showed up in infant formula and in pet food. And melamine should not be in food in any substantial quantity because it's a plasticizer. It's used to make bottles soft. You know, it's used in plastic processing. So a little bit might migrate out, but not in the quantities that we're seeing, not in single percentages or more. And that was a real concern because all of a sudden there was global problems. There was entire supply chains that were impacted. And that really raised some questions and that brought food fraud on the radar. And that was about the time that we were working on a lot of food fraud or food protection or product protection strategies. And throughout that time, GFSI was a real key part of the process. So the GFSI board of directors created a food fraud think tank. We were one of six people on the think tank with Dan and Led, with Walmart, Ahold, Eurofins, some others. And then that was giving GFSI, the board, a review of what is food fraud and is it something that GFSI should address? And then as we were working on that project, you know, around 2012, 2011, horse meat hit. And if the topic wasn't hot already, it was rocket hot. And it was definitely a top issue because horse meat was the potential risk to the industry. It was catastrophic for a company. So that really led the belief that food fraud was really, really important and something that needed to be addressed. A key, I think, is that we, among some other people, were looking at prevention. We're not just looking at catching it, we're looking at preventing it. And that's applying crime theories, criminology theories, situational crime prevention and others, as well as integrating that into the quality management process. So Six Sigma, the quality management systems, they look at finding the root causes and reducing the potential for an anomaly at that root cause. And the combination then led, especially GFSI, to take it on, you know, really to the forefront. And I think with that and then the range of prevention focus areas has really led food fraud prevention to really become something that's very well received and very efficient to implement because the theories are pretty simple.
I'm curious. You mentioned melamine, and I know when that broke, there was a clamor by different companies to develop methods and tests to look for melamine. And so the question became, how do you look for something that you never would have even suspected would be there?
A real issue with melamine was that it was such a surprise. And I think that when we're, you know, in our day-to-day activities as humans, we have to filter out the world and we have to make sense of it. We have to get down to a narrow focus. And so in food safety, we don't test the food is safe. We test it for the presence or absence of known bad things, whether bad bugs or bad chemicals, using the SIFSAN categories. So we weren't looking for melamine. We weren't looking for what was wrong. But when crime science, that there's a real process and system to scan constantly for what is there a new type of crime occurring or has a current type of crime evolved? And if I go back to the human trafficking examples, is that there's different ways people try to get across the borders. That as long as there's an iterative process to continue to review how things change, then we'll stay ahead of it. And then we'll actually go looking for not only melamine in there, but then to say, well, why was melamine in there? So to boost the protein content, what else could be in there that's like melamine? Then we're starting to really narrow down to see what we should look for. And then the bigger question strategically is, why would someone put melamine in there in the first place? And it was to deceive tests. So whether it's protein or it's some type of enzyme or vitamin or others, then that's something that's the common type of crime motivation. So when we apply these very simple criminology theories, then we've already got tried and true processes that can help us to protect the product.
Right. I'm curious whether you feel that the broader food industry is concerned about food fraud or just those particular manufacturers who are, say, making pomegranate juice and have to be concerned with authenticity or olive oil or a product that has gotten a lot of attention in that regard.
Well, it's interesting to look at who in the food industry cares and is acting on food fraud. And one thing that we've seen when we take this enterprise-wide view, that definitely at the highest levels, food fraud is an enterprise-wide risk, like any other risk that's in the company. So what we see is companies are now starting to assess that risk from the top down, and it fits into their current enterprise risk management systems. So we see that evolution of that of food fraud being incorporated at that level. Now, at the other end are people that are looking at regulatory compliance or at current incidents, so the normal operations. And so we often see inside the same company, an operations person or regulatory compliance person will have no interest in addressing food fraud. But we know that senior people or different people or crisis management teams are working on it, you know, at a really aggressive pace. So what's important across the perspective or the continuum here is that there's now standard operating procedures and there's now regulatory compliance or some type of compliance. So it's really critical that GFSI has come out. So by January 2018, any company, every company that wants to be GFSI compliant, which are most of the major supply chain around the world, every company will have to have, it is not optional, a food fraud vulnerability assessment that they can show to an auditor written, and a food fraud prevention plan that they can show to an auditor that's written. So companies are now starting to implement that and starting to ask the question of, you know, what's in there. At that point, people start to look closer, since they're already developing it, they have to develop it. They start to look closer at regulatory compliance, like FSMA, and they start to look in there. And something that's unique about the economically motivated adulteration or food fraud sections of FSMA is that it doesn't require people to explicitly do anything for food fraud because you're already doing a hazard assessment for all fraud, but, and this is the big key, it holds companies accountable for everything. So it doesn't require them to do anything specific for food fraud EMA, but it holds them accountable if an incident occurs. So during an inspection, then someone might come in and say, you know, have you reviewed the hazards that require preventive control for EMA food fraud? And you might be able to say yes. Now, it's different if it's an investigation. Inspection versus investigation. For an inspection, they're just trying to confirm compliance, that you're doing the things you said you do and that are required. For an investigation, they're looking for prosecution, potential criminal violations. That's a whole different story. And there's a lot more detailed questions, reviews of the process. So in that step, if an incident occurs, if a baby dies and there's an investigation, then a question would be, how did you determine this to not be a hazard that requires a preventive control? That's a whole different question. So that's been important. The third step that's important is to look at what's happening now in Codex. So Codex Alimentarius, Codex is not a law. It's the Global Food Code. So managed by the WHO and the UN's group on FAO, they set what the expectations are globally for a competent food system. But really, it's about half the countries of the world adopt Codex for their food laws. So what we've seen with Codex, just on May 5th, one of the committees created a working group to look at the definitions of food fraud and specifically address food fraud prevention, look at best practices to codify it in Codex. So we see the U.S. working in a bit on it, but not so much. Codex is defining it, GFSI is out there. And so now we're starting to see a real clarity on what the expectation will be.
You reference the enterprise risk management systems, and I know that you've published a lot on the different tools available that companies can use to look at their vulnerability for fraud. So take us through some of those tools and what companies can do to lower their risk of fraud.
Yeah, key is that when we started to look at prevention, that was a big breakthrough, that we looked at preventing food fraud, not detecting it. So we looked at things like the quality management system. And then a question above that a lot of people don't really think about is, how do companies decide on these culture changes? So what I mean by that is something like quality. I was at Chevron at the time, and so quality was a new thing. And we called them actually 31 flavors. So the flavor of the month. So we'd wait and see how long things lasted, because there are always new initiatives. But something like quality, the corporate board, the board of directors decided that the enterprise was at risk by bad quality and could get worse and worse. So they decided to invest because it was good for the business, you know, improving and maintaining the rate of return on the investment in the business, to implement a quality management system. So at Chevron, quality is now a part of the culture, but it doesn't just pop up to say, hey, let's do this because it's the right thing to do. It's doing it because it does help the company stay in business. The same at Chevron occurred for worker safety, that we had a lot of lost downtime and injuries that were costly. And so Chevron saw that at the board level as a real risk to the enterprise, to the impacting the business. So Chevron is also now a culture of safety. Beyond that, sustainability. So people like Walmart didn't originally decide on sustainability because they wanted to save trees and owls things. It was because their business was going to be impacted by higher costs, but also merchandising. Consumers wanted that product. So, you know, companies adapt. And that's one thing we're seeing with enterprise risk management, is that at the highest level, companies have had to implement ERM at some point because of regulations, which is Sarbanes-Oxley in the U.S. That's 2002 it was implemented. So they have to do these internal controls. But now they see that it's something that helps their entire business control their activities. Because enterprise risk management, what it does is it looks at every type of vulnerability across their entire company and has a process and a method to analyze it. So first off, we had quality. We're trying to implement the quality principles into food fraud prevention, but we didn't have a way to decide whether this is something that should have resource allocation for it. And that's when we saw ERM. So ERM with the quality management system puts everything together to start to be able to judge food fraud in relation to all other risks.
We're going to be soon to publish an article from the S-Safe Group using their vulnerability assessment tool. Are those global tools something that you talk about when you travel abroad, or are you working with outside groups globally to develop some new tools to use?
Yeah, that's one thing that's real key is for us with our group, we have no intellectual property. Everything we do, we publish, and we try to engage everybody and anybody. So S-Safe is a group that we definitely, you know, we know quite well, as a lot of the other people working in and around the space. What's important is that there are tools and processes being developed. And once we have standard or harmonized systems, we can start to do benchmarking. We can do process improvement. So S-Safe has been really important because their vulnerability assessment was the first major one that came out. And it was a key with that one is that it was endorsed by GFSI. So, you know, I've been talking about GFSI compliance. And so a real key is the S-Safe model. The vulnerability assessment is aligned with the needs of GFSI. So these systems that are out there are, and again, the real key is trying to have some standardized systems so we're all on the same page.
It seems that since the, you know, food supply chain is global, from sourcing ingredients to shipping products or importing products, that everyone really should be on the same page. You've done some work recently looking at food fraud in China. Are there areas of the world like Asia that pose more of a challenge for counterfeiting or other fraud risk?
You know, it's interesting that the fraud opportunity is different everywhere for everybody. It's very unique. And so one thing that we've seen is when we first took a food approach to it, we tried to look at standardized systems and responses because E. coli is not that much different around the world, so we can standardize more. But when it comes to human perpetrators and these very, very different supply chains, supply methods, processes, manufacturing conditions, then it's just, there's almost an infinite number of variables. That's not a challenge for crime science because crime science was developed considering all those variables. So the thing that's been great is so we have to shift our focus a little bit from the exact process steps or a prescribed approach, but to a more general approach that is consistent. So going into, you know, almost any situation, the first thing we assume is that we don't know anything about the situation. I mean, we may have some experience of melamine occurring in pet food in Cincinnati, Ohio, but that may or may not have anything to do with melamine occurring in Atlanta, Georgia, or London, or Mumbai. And so we start out with this very broad you know, tried and true criminology methods to create the foundation.
I think that's really interesting to be able to blend the food science part with the criminology part and look at human behaviors and try and tease out where the next risk might be coming from.
What we see is when with food fraud, I think one reason why the food fraud prevention wasn't really fully addressed in the past is because it's extremely interdisciplinary. You know, we've got the food testing, which is really hardcore food science and chemistry. And we've got consumer behavior, which is a field in and of itself. There's entire departments and PhDs and professors on consumer behavior. Risk analysis is different than decision making, even from a science standpoint. Enterprise risk management fits in there. So that's business. And then we add criminology. We add public policy, you know, political science, supply chain management. It's very interdisciplinary. And I think in the past, There were efforts that tried to grow from one discipline upwards. And really one thing that we saw early on, we were put in a position with our food fraud initiative to pursue the question, not the answer. So we really looked at how the decisions were made and then worked down from there. So I think that's one thing that we've seen is you know, very interdisciplinary. So even looking at you know, crime science is critical to understanding the fraud opportunity. But it's one thing that once we mentioned that, at first people thought we were crazy because those two things have never interacted. So, you know, social science and food science and criminology. But in reality, it makes total sense because the biological organism in question is not a microbe. If it was, we would go to the field of microbiology. And managing it in a food system would be food science. The biological organism in question is a human. So it's natural to go to the human sciences, which is social science, and specifically a crime act, which is crime science.
I'm all about multidisciplinary. I think that's a terrific approach. What do you think our priorities should be for reducing risk of food fraud and improving our defense against intentional adulteration? I mean, can you identify some low-hanging fruit that might not take a lot of resources by companies that they could implement quickly? And then what should we be focusing on long-term, do you think?
The answer is process, process, process. And the key is at the very start is to look at the holistic problem, look at all types of fraud, and consider how it would be managed. A real problem is if we get too detailed into looking at just adulterant substances or stolen goods or counterfeits, then systems get created that are optimized for that type of crime. And then that system is very inflexible because you just get set in your ways. So the thing we see is to consider at the very start, it's got to be a corporate level type policy, address food fraud broadly, and start to assess that strategy across the entire enterprise. And that enterprise could be a country or a company. So we definitely see this. We did a study of Nigeria's anti-counterfeiting, pharmaceutical anti-counterfeiting countermeasures. They looked at it countrywide. So really to start with that idea that we need to work very broadly from the top down. And then the very first step, which is, as we look back, it's completely critical and obvious, is that you need to assess where you are. How bad is the problem? Because the question is, how bad is this problem in relation to all other problems? And so what we're doing now is a lot of these enterprise-wide, country-wide, company-wide vulnerability assessments. It's a very quick pass. It's just looking very at high level, broad product groups of where there's fraud. And so we have that we call it a food fraud initial screening tool that we published in an academic journal and published in Food Safety Magazine as well, a summary. So a key is that we're starting to show these very easy first steps. And those can be, you know, we conduct workshops in 4 hours to go through that. Now, it's not real detailed, but at the start, the CEO at the board level doesn't need a lot of detail. They need to know, is this super crisis or not so bad? And that's about as much as they need. Well, the example would be for a CEO or a CFO. When they start to look at food fraud, one question they have is, should I alert the board right now that there's something really bad happening? The board of directors does not like surprises. So it's something, should they be alerting them now? Is this going to be a huge problem and a huge costly program? Or is it just something that we kind of can do? And depends on the fraud opportunity, which is unique for every country and every company. In some cases, we look at companies and they have very low fraud opportunity. They've never assessed it before, so they've never quantified it, but they have a very low fraud opportunity based on the types of products they buy, how they buy them, how they process them, and how they distribute them. So, you know, it's one of those things to just take a calm approach at the start. Don't start doing too much, but really get the process in place.
I was going to say, it sounds like simply if a company is importing some ingredients and they're doing the supplier verification and they're doing some ingredient testing and all their ducks are in a row, so to speak, that they are already with those plans in place for preventive controls, that they're reducing their risk at the outset.
There's a lot of things we can do by everyday business operations are pretty good. So a lot of our, you know, if a company's in control in a lot of other areas, they probably are okay. I think it's like a human that's sick. So if you look at the person sitting next to you, you look at them and tell me, do you think they look healthy or not? You know, well, I'm not sure. Now, if they have a bone sticking out of their leg, you know something's wrong. If they're passed out, well, that doesn't look very good. But you don't really have any idea internally. Now, if someone goes to a doctor and says, I don't feel good, help me. Well, the doctor doesn't immediately start treating you for cancer or a broken leg. They would look at you and really look deep And if there are some triggers that make the doctor concerned, they may look deeper and deeper. And part of it is, you know, your lifestyle. That's why they ask questions. Do you smoke? Do you exercise? How much do you drink? You know, do you have a stressful job? How are you sleeping? Those are broad categories to understand the patient itself. That's exactly the same with what we do with food fraud, is that we look at the patient and we get a good feel of whether they have a bone sticking out of their leg. But, you know, managing diabetes and fixing a broken leg are two different things. And food fraud is really more generally like managing diabetes. The patient may look fine, but you need to watch closely because it can go downhill quickly.
So what are some of the red flags that jump out at you when you're talking with government officials or leaders at a company that suggest you might have to look a little deeper?
Well, really what we do a lot is it's the types of products that people buy and how they buy them. And then after that, it's how they receive them into their system. So it's almost like protecting your house from burglary. You know, there's a lot of different things you have in place. So there are some products that have a higher fraud opportunity in general. You know, you could think of things like ground spices. There's a couple things going on there. One is it's high price for the spice, and then ground that it's mixed, it's commingled, it's mingled in there. And so it would be, you know, it's not like you're buying a whole fish and you can look at the fish and see that it's not been replaced. So there's some things inherent in the process. So something like ground spices or something that's fluid, you know, different types of things that have popped up on a lot of lists are extra virgin olive oil compared to regular olive oil. And then it's how you buy product. So if you buy the most risky product in the world, but you buy it directly from one of the best spice companies there is, then your fraud opportunity is very low. As long as they deliver it to your doc or you pick it up at their doc, then the fraud opportunity is very low because they're managing their system. They already know that there's a high fraud opportunity. So that's one thing of how you buy it. If you buy it from just anybody or a broker or off the e-commerce, just a website for eBay or something, then there's higher risks because you don't know the process. And then finally is how you process it. So there's something like making beer that they can have variations in the process and know if some of the grain is too humid in their own storage facilities, because it's a product that's processed so much and there's so much control with the carbonation and fermentation. So they have so much process control that they probably would notice a quality anomaly. So those are things we really look together between those to see where there's a fraud opportunity. A key is that the bad guys, they are very creative, resourceful, often well-funded, because this could be a huge operation, and just so intelligent adversaries. Some of the types of fraud we've seen have been absolutely brilliant from a chemistry standpoint to deceive a test, just brilliant. So we really need to look at food fraud across the board. And there's a hierarchy from the way people handle products, but you know, just to do it's going to the doctor and continuing to look at your health.
You know, it's interesting that to hear you be so complimentary for some of the fraudsters. I do remember hearing that if they had used pure melamine instead of scrap melamine, they probably would have gotten away with it. It would have been a lot harder to narrow that down, or would have taken longer at least.
A key with melamine is that melamine itself is not harmful to humans. And that was actually quoted in a Woodrow Wilson Institute has a report called Sowing the Seeds that actually was published simultaneously at the same time that the incidents of melamine in milk were breaking out in China. And so they were stating there that melamine itself was not harmful to humans. Now, they might not have meant at 10% levels, but it wasn't. But a key is that the melamine was combined with other contaminants that did create the cyanuric acid. So it was the contaminants combined that really, really caused the problems. The key is that there's not, you know, one fraudster network, that a lot of fraudsters might hear about some things and just try things. Or somebody gets greedy. They put more and more melamine in and it starts to cause more problems. So that's something we see. We don't expect a lot of these products to be in there.
Right. It's interesting that you referred a lot over the course of our conversation to culture, and that many of these decisions by company boards or heads of governments really have to be made from the top down. And perhaps this is a little bit of a selfless plug for our article series on food safety culture, but that is really, at many of the meetings that I've attended, really key to reorganizing and reprioritizing what needs to be happening at these companies. Thank you very much, John, for spending some time with me today talking about food fraud. It's a continually evolving area, and perhaps after the GFSI meeting in Tokyo, if you are lucky enough to present out there, we'll have you back and you can update us on the latest advances globally in this interesting area.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We really appreciate you spending time with us, and we want to hear from you. Maybe you have ideas about who you'd like us to interview or what you've thought about the discussions that we've had so far. Let us know. Email us at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or through any of our social channels. Thanks again to Don Schaffner and John Spink for sharing their time and expertise with us. For resources from this episode, like links to the hand washing study and John Spink's articles in Food Safety Magazine, visit our show notes page on foodsafetymagazine.com under podcast episode 5. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Food Safety Matters so you'll get each episode as soon as it's posted. And be sure and share the podcast with your colleagues or on your social networks. That's it for us today. Our next episode will post on July 25th. We'll talk to you then.
Before we start, can anyone hear the lawnmower that I hear outside my window?
No, I don't think I do. Because I can't hear it over the helicopter Good. Out of my window. Ah.